Some new laws passed by the 2013 legislature take effect today. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us how an oboist who lost his ability to play got it back again. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the director of the Montana Department of Environmental Quality about the first phase of the Clark Fork River cleanup near Warm Springs. More than a half dozen laws take effect in the new year, laws passed by the 2013 legislature. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us one of them changes how independent candidates can make it on the ballot.
House Bill 120 has the broad title of Generally Revise Election Laws. Deputy Secretary of State Eric Stern calls it mostly a cleanup bill.
Small things, I's need to be redotted and language needs to be cleaned up and made clearer.
He says one of these fixes is pretty substantive, though.
Independent candidates for office now have until June to gather their many signatures that they need to collect.
It used to be March, but a federal court judge ruled that placed an undue burden on minor party candidates. See, if you're a candidate in what's called a qualifying party, right now that's the Republican, Democratic, and Libertarian parties, they qualify by having a certain number of candidates on ballots over a certain amount of time. If you're in one of those parties, you can just put your name in and say, I'm a candidate, here I am. But if you're an independent or another minor party candidate, you need to gather signatures.
They need to gather 5% of the total number of voters who voted in support of the last successful candidate for that office.
Did you catch that? Well, here's an example.
I believe that Max Baucus won with something like 290,000 votes last time.
So if you're an independent candidate who wants to file for Max Baucus's open Senate seat, and there is one, Helena nonprofit worker Sean Whitewolf, he'll have to gather somewhere under 15,000 signatures. This law will give him a few more months to do so. Some other laws which take effect with the start of the year, a bill which requires insurance companies to make efforts to find the beneficiaries of unclaimed life insurance policies. Another which allows military veterans to get a new driver's license which says veteran on it. There's also one which will give a $500 tax credit to landowners who provide public access through their properties to reach isolated parcels of state land. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, Montana Public Service Commissioner Bill Gallagher says he is not seeking re-election after the pancreatic cancer he was diagnosed with in June spread to his liver. Gallagher, a 54-year-old Helena attorney, said yesterday he plans to serve out his remaining term, which ends in January 2015. Gallagher tells the Daily Interlake that with chemotherapy, his doctors have given him a 3% chance to live for the next 5 years. He tells Lee Newspapers of Montana he wants to focus on his work, his family, and, quote, beating this abominable disease, end quote, without undertaking a re-election campaign. Gallagher is a Republican on the commission that oversees electricity, natural gas, telephone, and water companies doing business in Montana. His district includes Lewis and Clark, Flathead, Glacier, Lake, Ponderay, and Teton counties. A Missoula judge entered a not guilty plea on behalf of a 25-year-old man charged with beating his grandmother to death with a chair. Tyler Dan Perry is charged with deliberate homicide in the December 14th death of 72-year-old Carol Ann Perry. Yesterday, Perry's attorneys asked District Judge Karen Townsend if she could help expedite their client's evaluation at the Montana State Hospital in Warm Springs. Public Defender Scott Spencer said he had been told it would take 3 to 4 months before Perry could be evaluated for his fitness to stand trial. Charging documents say Perry stated his grandmother had a third eye and added that, quote, everybody knew we had to bash her over the head, end quote. Townsend said she would have an aide contact the hospital. A man who is serving an 18-year federal prison sentence on a child pornography charge has been sentenced to a concurrent 15-year sentence for raping an 11-year-old girl. KCI-TV reports District Judge Karen Townsend sentenced Roger Allen Roybal yesterday to 30 years in state prison with 15 suspended to run concurrently with his federal sentence for receipt of child pornography. In addition, Roybal was ordered to pay over $33,000 in restitution to help cover counseling costs for the girl, who said Roybal molested her from August to December 2010 in Missoula. Roybal had been living in both Helena and Missoula. Butte Silver Bow County authorities are searching for two suspects in the armed robbery of a store in which the elderly owner was tied up. The Montana Standard reports warrants have been issued for Dale Edward Wallace and Sarah Jo Johnson, both 30. Sheriff Ed Lester says Wallace and Johnson are suspected of pointing a large caliber handgun at the owner of Coins and Cards in Butte on Monday, tying him up and stealing five guns, cash, and collectible coins. The shop owner, who is in his 70s, was able to maneuver out of his restraints to call 911 just before 6 p.m. Monday. Lester says the suspects are believed to be driving a 2014 white Jeep Commando. He initially said they may be traveling to eastern Montana, but today he said there was a credible sighting in Missoula yesterday. Organizers, artists, and supporters of First Night Missoula rang in the new year and celebrated the event's own 20th anniversary yesterday. The Missoula Arts Council presents the event each year, and Executive Director Tom Benson says attendance may have been a bit lighter than normal, but picked up as the day went on.
It was the middle of the week, and it was a beautiful day, and I think early in the day it was attendance was a little light. But as the day went on, particularly downtown, I think because the weather was so nice, people were out and about and walking around the streets, and a lot of the venues were quite full later on in the evening.
Benson says the First Night Missoula event brings the community together through appreciation of the arts.
The goal is to have a community-wide celebration of New Year's Eve and have the focus be on the arts. And the community stepped up, and people came out, and people contributed, both artists and supporters and volunteers. So it's a community building project. And so in that sense, we achieved our goal, and we've done that every year for 20 years.
The event offered activities all day for people of all ages in many different venues, from live music and dance performances to hands-on science activities and even ice carving. St. James Healthcare in Butte has agreed to pay $3.85 million to resolve allegations that the hospital improperly provided financial benefits to a group of physicians that referred patients covered by Medicaid and other government healthcare programs to the hospital. St. James CEO Chuck Wright tells the Montana Standard the hospital reported the violations, which occurred in 2005, after an internal compliance review that took place in 2009. Wright became CEO in early 2009. The Department of Justice said yesterday the physicians group paid below-market lease rates for a medical office building located on the hospital campus. Hospital officials would not identify the physician group. The fine settles allegations that the hospital violated a law that restricts the financial relationships that hospitals can have with physicians who refer patients to them. Glacier Symphony in Corral's principal oboist had to give up his seat when a tremor made his hands shake so violently he could no longer play. Reed Murley is now back playing, leading his section. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more on how a treatment for Parkinson's patients got Murley back into the concert seat.
Reed Murley has been playing the oboe since he was 11 years old.
Except for 2 years when I didn't play, I've been playing 46 years.
To save you the math, that makes him 57 years old. The 2 years he didn't play was 2007 through 2009. Murley first noticed a tremor in 2005. His arms would just shake, but only when he picked up his instrument to play. He was able to hide it for a while.
I had to change my reed style so that the reeds were really easy to blow, because using my vibrato would sometimes set it off even more. So I had to rethink doing everything, and so I did.
Murley's partner, Sherry Parmeter, is also a musician, playing the oboe and the English horn.
We were practicing with an accompanist, and he was playing the English horn, and I looked over, and his hand was shaking dramatically, and I had never seen that, and I was really surprised, shocked, and didn't know what it was. And then the next day when we were performing, he was playing on the flute, and he couldn't control the flute. He couldn't even keep it at his mouth. His arms were going up and down.
Murley says he hit the point where he couldn't play anymore in August of 2010 for a Mozart oboe quartet.
But then the day of the concert, we were rehearsing it, and I couldn't control anything. So it was the first time I had to actually just cancel out, and that was bad.
Parmeter says the doctors thought it was an essential tremor. She thought differently. Parmeter had read a book by Oliver Sacks called Musicophilia, which talked about musicians' dystonia. Murley says the difference is that an essential tremor is a more general diagnosis, while dystonia happens in specific parts of the brain. Parmeter says they tried different anti-tremor medications and Botox injections in his arms.
Reed went to extreme lengths to try to play. He put on the wrist things that people have if they have carpal tunnel, and he would strap himself down to a music stand, and he wore straps to try and hold his arms still. He tried everything he could.
Murley had played in the 6th Army Band, and his medical is taken care of through the Veterans Administration. A neurologist at the Helena VA believed the tremor was related to neck issues and nerve damage, and he was referred to a Kalispell neurosurgeon in late 2010.
But once we got to see the neurosurgeon here in Kalispell, he said, that problem's in his brain. And I said, yes, that's right. It's in his brain.
Murley was sent to the VA in Portland, Oregon.
They finally decided that deep brain stimulation was probably the way to go. And they had never done that before for my condition, so I was sort of a guinea pig.
Basically, the surgeons look at Murley's brain, pinpoint where the trouble is, and insert an electrical charge into the spot. It's a treatment that's used for the tremor that Parkinson's patients have. How did they pinpoint the location? They had a grid-like metal helmet put on Murley's head. His brain was exposed, and he played scales on the oboe.
While they're cutting into your head, you're awake. And then I think that they place some of the little probes or something and figure out if it's in the right place, and then you have to try to play. And then when they hit the right area, then the tremor stopped.
Now, Murley has a little remote that turns the electrodes on and off in his brain. For Parkinson's patients, the charge is on all the time. Murley only switches his on when it's time to play. That's the only time he has the tremor, and the only time he needs it. Murley still shakes a bit while playing. He says it's a bit of a trade-off. The charge needed to completely eradicate the tremor dulls his dexterity. The surgery took place in March of 2012. He was playing again by that summer.
When you see someone who is as wonderful playing an instrument with the kind of musicality and feeling that Reed has, and you play the same instrument, and you see them falling apart, it's really difficult to watch. And it was very difficult for me sitting next to him, wondering if he was going to make it through the concert as he was having more and more tremors. And now seeing him get stronger and stronger and stronger every month is just amazing. So I was crying at a lot of concerts as he was falling apart, and now I cry at the concerts because he's getting so good.
He, Parmeter, and the entire Glacier Symphony and Chorale will be performing The Carnival of the Animals on January 18th and 19th in Whitefish and Kalispell. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
The Montana Department of Environmental Quality announced this week the first phase of the Clark Fork River cleanup near Warm Springs is mostly complete. In tonight's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, DEQ Director Tracy Stone Manning says this first of the 15-year project was a tremendous success.
Back in the heyday of mining, we didn't quite have the regulations we have in place now. And so when there was a giant flood in 1908, that flood took mine tailings and washed it from Butte and Anaconda all the way down the Clark Fork River. And it settled out along the riverbanks and on the floodplain. And over 100 years later, there are places that literally do not grow anything. And the river has suffered the result of that for over 100 years.
What sort of contaminants are we talking about?
Mostly heavy metals.
And is any of this actually in the riverbed itself, or is it mostly, as you said, along the banks and floodplain?
It's in the river as well, but the biggest problem is it keeps getting washed into the river, right? Summer floods will happen and come across mine tailings, hit the water, and kill a bunch of fish. And so the fish population has never been able to fully rebound as it needed to. And it also, of course, creates a threat to human health because, you know, arsenic and other heavy metals are not things that we should trifle with.
Tell us about the cleanup itself. What was done? How was it accomplished?
Well, the Superfund program came along, and the river was listed on a national list of the Superfund sites way back in the 80s. And the EPA and the state of Montana did a lot of analysis to figure out the very best way to clean up that river. And decisions were made, documents were created, and in March, we finally started the cleanup. And it involves, in some cases, digging up mine tailings and hauling them away to Opportunity, to the waste repository there. And in some cases, it means treating some of that waste in place. And then basically rebuilding the river, right? Rebuilding the river floodplain by planting willows and other riparian vegetation. So in short, taking away the waste and putting back in its place what is supposed to be there, which is healthy vegetation.
How much was hauled away?
This year is the first of a 15-year cleanup, and we hauled away about 330,000 cubic yards of mine waste, and we planted thousands and thousands of native shrubs and willows and other vegetation. And I'm happy to say that this first year has been incredibly successful. It is a humbling and daunting task to try and put a river back together, and we took a great amount of effort and humility to the task, and we're really pleased with the results, and we're pleased for the work ahead and what it'll mean in 15 or so years when it's all done.
What do you think it'll mean in the next 15 or so years?
Rivers provide us so much. They provide us clean water for drinking. They provide us water for agricultural use. They provide us water for recreation. And to be able to bring a river back to fully functioning life is a remarkable opportunity. And so 15 years from now, when this is all said and done, and we have a thriving river, finally the landowners who for over 100 years have lived in a valley that had unacceptable mining impacts will live in a different and better place.
Which agencies came together to make this happen?
Well, the Federal Superfund program is driven by the Environmental Protection Agency, and we could not have done this work without them. They've been a remarkable partner in this, and the state of Montana is the lead agency for the cleanup itself, but we work with the EPA, and of course, we also work with the Natural Resource Damage Program, which is also housed at the state of Montana, which does restoration over and above the cleanup that we'll be doing.
How did it go? And I ask because sometimes when you get a group of agencies and entities and individuals on such a big project, horns can sometimes lock. Was there much of that?
Oh, there's quite a bit of opinion about what is the right way to fix a river. It's a relatively new sort of profession on the landscape, if you think about it. And it is, like I said, a daunting thing to do. So were there differences of opinion about how to go about it? Absolutely. But now that we're in the cleanup itself, I can't tell you how important it has been to have the cooperation of landowners, to have the cooperation of the counties that we're working in, and to have the cooperation of our fellow professionals at the EPA and at NRD.
Did you and your colleagues want to get the public involved in this, or was it kind of keep them at bay for the moment?
Oh, heck no. We cannot do this cleanup without the public's full involvement, their understanding of what's happening. I mean, trucks are coming and going, for example. And to work in a river in a valley is a big, big effort. And so without their understanding and without their support, we simply couldn't do this work. And so we took monthly tours with folks who wanted to see what was going on. We did as much sort of outreach and education as possible to let people know that this is happening right in their backyard.
You mentioned it was 330,000 cubic yards of mine waste. How long a stretch of river was it? Was that a half mile, a mile, 10 miles? What?
That was on a mile and a half. And as we go downriver, we fully expect to remove less mine waste because back when the flood happened, of course, the mine waste was coming from upstream. So the further we get downriver, the less impact there is, and so the less hauling away we will need to do.
So the heavy lifting has already been done, it sounds.
The big first stretch of heavy lifting is behind us, and we are very grateful for its success.
Okay, so then what's the next immediate goal here?
So the next goal is to move downstream, and we were working this year on land owned by the state of Montana, and now we'll move on to private ranches. And so it will take a great deal of work sitting at folks' kitchen tables, finding out exactly what their concerns are, what their needs are, and working hand-in-hand with each landowner whose property we're on to fix the river and to hopefully make the ranch more functioning in the end, the ability to raise more crops, just have a healthier landscape. But there will be disruption, no doubt about it.
What's your initial feel? Do you think you'll mostly have a receptive audience, these private landowners, or a bit of a skeptical?
I think it's a combination of both. The talk of cleanup has been coming for 2 decades. And so anytime there's change, that causes concern. And you know, who wouldn't be concerned by that kind of sort of heavy lifting on their property? But the work so far and the reaction so far with landowners has been remarkable. They've been great partners, and we're not going to be able to do it without them, and we want them to be the biggest beneficiary in the end.
You've talked about the environmental and, I guess, social benefits of cleanup, if you will. What about the economic benefits of this? Are lots of jobs, lots of money being created here?
Absolutely. So here we are. This is a great example of what folks call the restoration economy. Roughly somewhere between 70 and 100 people, everybody sitting from desks to folks, you know, in heavy machinery alongside the river, were employed this summer. And it's going to be about $111 million to clean this whole river up over 15 years. And of course, that money came from the Atlantic Richfield Company as a settlement to the whole Superfund process. And we're going to pump money and jobs into that valley and walk away with a much, much richer landscape as a result.
Well, what a way to end the year for you and your partners and all the stakeholders in this, huh?
We are very glad that it's in the rearview mirror and that it was a success. And we remain excited about the future ahead and also acknowledge that it is a remarkable task that we are undertaking and that we're not going to be able to do it without our partners, our landowners, and our the local government and the EPA. And we're excited about how working together we're going to do great things. And it's such an example for any kind of work that the state of Montana does. The more we work together, the better off we're going to be.
Tracy Stone Manning, Montana Department of Environmental Quality Director, thank you so much for your time and a very happy 2014 to you and yours.
And you. Thanks, Edward.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter storm watch in effect from tomorrow afternoon through late Friday night for the West Glacier region. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow and low 16 to 23 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow and highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there's a winter storm watch in effect from tomorrow afternoon through late Friday night for the Rocky Mountain Front. There's also a high wind warning in effect from 6 a.m. tomorrow to 5 p.m. Friday for the Rocky Mountain Front, as well as Glacier, Hill, Cascade, Shodo, Central and Southern Lewis and Clark County, Toole, Liberty, Eastern Ponderay, Blaine, Eastern Teton, Judith Basin, and Fergus counties. Tonight, look for increasing clouds with lows 10 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with highs 35 to 45 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 50 miles per hour in the afternoon. And in southwest Montana, there's a high wind watch in effect from Thursday afternoon through Friday afternoon for Jefferson and Broadwater counties. Tonight, look for increasing clouds with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with highs in the 30s. And now for the editorial comments of Mark Hansen.
On New Year's Day, many of us make resolutions to do certain things for self-improvement. The ancient Greeks thought that becoming a better person was the product of taking on certain traits of excellence called virtues, traits like courage and justice. One learns virtues by imitation. Imitate a good person, and you will become a good person. Two good men highly praised in recent weeks are Pope Francis and the late Nelson Mandela. They are leaders of a singular type, ones who embody a particular virtue scarcely seen in most leaders, but one that our society seems to hunger for: humility. Named for the humble Saint Francis of Assisi, the self-effacing Pope has exchanged many of the ornate trappings of the papacy for simplicity. He has washed the feet of female convicts, kissed the face of the deformed, and made service of the poor and oppressed the center of his life and ministry. Nelson Mandela walked out of a 27-year imprisonment under the masters of apartheid to become president of South Africa. But as Dov Seidman, who advises CEOs on governance, observes, Mandela's leadership arose precisely out of the fact that he did not make the transition out of apartheid about him. By making himself small, Seidman argues, Mandela was able to inspire others to do the work of reconciliation. Humility is not self-denial as such. Rather, it is having the character to acknowledge one's limits and debts in addition to one's strengths. Humility makes the whole greater than the self. It stands with the lowliest among us first. Among its fruits are gratitude, solidarity, responsibility, and reconciliation. While humility is a personal virtue, there are two reasons for renewing our interest in it as a civic virtue as well. First, as Francis and Mandela illustrate, humility is an important source of moral authority, an essential element for the leadership necessary to reverse moral decline. The oft-heard criticism that politicians just don't get it is essentially a rejection of political self-promotion over service to others. Self-serving leadership cannot heal a nation's divisions. Mandela reached out to include his former enemies, rather than take revenge or seek their elimination. Think of how a little humility might have spared us the politics of extortion that caused the government shutdown, for example. Second, the success of any dialogue on divisive issues requires that all parties place the common good and devotion to the truth above personal or special interest. Yet humility also recognizes that no person, institution, or tradition possesses the entire truth. Aren't these the sort of things that people look for to ameliorate the growing cynicism and divisions in American culture and politics? One wonders why, then, in the worldwide outpouring of praise for Francis and Mandela, we don't see more people acting like them. The biggest reason, I suspect, is that our culture and its dominant institutions do little to foster the humble character. Spheres of real power, such as politics and business, rest largely on the values of self-promotion, individualism, and competition. And our culture encourages people to imitate the successful members of these spheres much more than it does the humble servant. It mistakes humility for weakness. Religious traditions would seem uniquely situated to provide examples of those who humble themselves before others, great and small. A moral tragedy of our times is that much of contemporary American Christianity, whose God comes humbly as a suffering servant born in a barn, has accommodated itself too much to the dominant values of culture. Or at least it has often lacked the courage to provide powerful and prophetic critiques of culture for fear of alienating the comfortable. It strays when it emphasizes certainty and dogma rather than the humility of non-judgmental love. That's why Pope Francis stands out as such a refreshing character. Mandela's school in humility arose from the depths of suffering, another experience which, while not desirable in itself, has been expunged of any purpose in our times. It is rarely viewed as an opportunity for forming character. So as we look into a new year with hope, perhaps it is time we hold not just ourselves but our leaders to the virtues embodied by figures like Francis and Mandela. Imagine political leaders congratulating their opponents for good ideas or standing with the poor rather than blaming them. Imagine religious leaders not claiming God's knowledge and doctrine, but humbling themselves in service. Imagine people taking responsibility not just for their own behavior, but also for the behavior of those around them and for the social conditions that influence it. But don't just imagine it. Expect it this year, of ourselves first, then of others. Maybe we don't all have the gifts to be as Pope Francis or Nelson Mandela, but I believe that we and our world would be better off if we tried. Happy New Year, everyone. This is Mark Hansen, guest commentator for the Mansfield Program in Ethics and Public Affairs at the University of Montana.
Mark Hansen is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.